I've been a church guy all my life. There have been times when I have bought that, times when I felt ambivalent about it, times when I've embraced it, but the reality is I've never escaped it. Some of my earliest memories are of being in church. When I was 10 years old, it was the minister of the church my family and I were attending at the time, a little town of St. Albans, West Virginia, who gave me the model for who and what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I followed his model, became a minister. Whether I ever grew up or not, it's another matter. And I will admit there's a little bit of a Peter Pan in me. As many of you know, my own religious journey did go from evangelical Christianity to liberal mainline Protestant Christianity to Unitarian Universalism. And I've been very much involved in the lives of congregations at all three of those stops, including this one, which I believe now has well over half the time I've spent in the ministry altogether, been right here. And I guess in one respect, I could invoke the words of the late Jerry Garcia and say what a long, strange trip it's been. But in another sense, it hasn't been all that strange at all. Because at all three stops, I've seen people come into the lives of congregations and become deeply involved with them for many of the same reasons, even with all the pronounced differences in theology and the ways of doing religion at those three stops I've made. Pick up on this point a little later. I have to say, really, it's been more of a fascinating trip than it's been a strange one. The fascinating part for me at each of the three just mentioned stops has been in witnessing men and women devote a substantial chunk of their lives and times of the energy and the skills and their financial resources to the life of a congregation that they are just as free to ignore if they choose. And by that I mean there's nothing and nobody that is forcing them, forcing any one of you, to become involved as a congregant in the workings of a religious community. It's something they choose to do, even as they of you are free also not to make that choice. And I think that's been the really fascinating part. It's also been the most gratifying part of the journey to date for me. Seeing people make the free choice to make the life of a congregation of whatever religious hue or stripe it may be, to make that an integral part of their lives. And somewhere along the way on this trip, I picked up some terminology that's helped me to understand that choice a little better. It's called the third place. And I don't know when I first ever heard that phrase, actually, or who even coined it, but it's still, I think, a pretty good one. And it's a very simple concept once you kind of break it out. It kind of goes like this. Your first place is your family. By family, I mean family in all the many and varied ways in which family can be defined. Your first place is with and among those people with whom you have your primary relationships, to whom you feel the most responsible, who call for the greatest level of commitment on your part. And so contained within your first place, then, is all that goes into being a good, responsible, caring, and loving family member. Again, with those whom you regard as family in the closest sense. Second place is where and how you make a living. Your career, your job, your trade. This doesn't require a whole lot of explanation, since practically all of you know what it means to have a job and all the demands that go with that. Also aware that there are those of you right now who may not have a job or are wondering what the status of that is. That's all part of that second place. I would guess, without knowing myself, but I would guess that even those who are independently wealthy have the job, so to speak, of managing their wealth, the kind of job we all feel we'd really just be so good at if we could just get a chance to do it. Well, anyway, your second place, then, it's where you go. It's what you do to support yourself and your family. And even in those families where a single spouse or a partner works outside the home, the other spouse is still affected, of course, by the demands, by all that goes into being a part of that second place. And then there's your third place. This one isn't always as clearly defined as the first two, but it's ever been as real, nonetheless. The third place, and it can actually be more than one locale, more than one area of activity, the third place is where you go to fill in or round out your life. It's where you choose to invest a certain portion of your time, your energy, your resources, and your passion. Even though this third place is not making the same kinds of explicit demands upon you as your first and second places do. But you still seek out a third place because of another kind of demand that it makes. It may be a less well-defined demand, as I said, that you get in places one or two, but it's still a demand, or maybe actually the better term would be impulse. It's an impulse to find your missing piece. Now, I'm guessing, since it's a very familiar text, I'm guessing that most of you are familiar with Shel Silverstein's book, The Missing Piece. Like most of Silverstein's work, this is a book for adults that's offered as children's literature, which it also is. The Giving Tree, another one of his, is of the same genre. Think about that book. You probably either read it or read it to a kid somewhere along the line. I've probably used it for a kid's story here once in a while. But the central character, I guess you could call it that, in the book, The Missing Piece, is a circle that sort of looks like it was drawn freehand by a child with a pie slice missing out of it. Well, actually, the circle, given my artistic ability, could have been drawn freehand by me, or it could have been drawn by freehand by much of us. Don't need to make this a kid thing, but if you've seen the book, you know what I mean. Kind of this sort of drawn circle with a slice of pie missing from it. And in the book, this sort of circle goes bouncing along from one page to the next with a little pie slice gone, and it's singing this little ditty, which I'm not going to sing, but the words go, I'm looking for my missing piece, I'm looking for my missing piece, so fleece my bees and grease my knees, I'm looking for my missing piece. Well, close you're ever going to get for me from a song from this poem here. Hokey as that may sound, Silverstein's book, complete with its nonsense rhyme, offers as good an explanation as any as to why we each and all seek a third place. We're looking for our missing piece. And the common thread that ran and runs through those three types of congregations I mentioned a few minutes ago is that for all their marked differences in theology, all their differing ways of worship, all their differing general ways of being, they are also made up of human beings who were looking for, and thankfully in many cases finding, their missing piece. So I would suggest then that for those of you who are members or who identify with this congregation in some way, you're here because this is the church you choose. You choose it because it is your third place where you are working on that missing piece, hopefully finding a good piece of it as well. For those of you who are still trying to get a feel for who we are here, or who may even today be checking us out for the first time, I hope we hold out the possibility of being your third place as well. And to play with the metaphor for just a little bit, your third place need not be, it often isn't, a place that is completely apart from places one or two. It can also be a place for your family, as it is for many of you. And it might even be a place, for some of you anyway, where you find you engage your co-workers in another kind of a setting, in another kind of way of relating to them. But the third piece then, third place then, is that piece of your life that more fully rounds out your overall life, gives it a greater sense of fullness and completion than might otherwise have. Well, before I hand things off to Ellen here, let me just add a few thoughts about this particular religious community as your third place, as another kind of home for you. I like to think of the kind of third place that we have here, both in physical locale, which is beautiful, which takes a certain amount to maintain as well, physical locale, and spirit, which is up here and amongst us, I think, not just every Sunday, but every time any of us get together here for anything. We've got a third place here, a locale and spirit. And it is where what you receive and what you give at its best becomes so intertwined as to become indistinguishable. Because at its best, that's really how any third place is supposed to work. The support, the love, the care you receive from one another here becomes indistinguishable from the support and the love and the care you give. The sense of commitment you find here to a crucial set of principles and values becomes one with the commitment that you also give to them. The deeper sense of meaning and purpose and depth you receive for your life here becomes, in turn, the ways in which you contribute to the search for meaning and purpose and depth in which your fellow members, all of us, all of our friends, are engaged. And so under the best of circumstances, and we constantly strive for the best of circumstances here, the giving and the receiving all come together. So you find a missing piece that's not missing at all. And one part of that giving means doing all that we can to assure that this will be the church that will long be here as a promising and exciting choice for those seeking their missing pieces, their third place, not just now, but in all the generations that will come after this, just as all the generations that preceded us, turn back to 1826, had that same sense of commitment. We want to continue to be the third place for those whose lives will find an extra measure of meaning and wholeness for their being here. I know these are not easy times, financially speaking, for some of us. And that's what makes it all more important, that we pull together, represented by what's all around the sanctuary today. We pull together to keep us being the sound and the very healthy place that we will continue and need to be. On that note, I'm going to invite Ellen Fisher to join me. Ellen, good to have you back. Is Kathy getting in on this one, or is this just you this time, huh? No. Out of the room. All right. Bye. Okay.
Thank you, Steve. This church is definitely a third place for me. I've been at UU for 30 years, and although I've enjoyed many people's stories of how they came to choose this church over the years, I have never written my story. With this year's pledge drive theme, The Church We Choose, which I kind of thought up, I began to think that maybe it was time to step up to the plate. And thinking about telling you why I chose this church actually brought up memories that I haven't revisited for many years, going all the way back to my fairly young childhood. It's a sort of small story, really, but here are some examples for me of very influential early thoughts that have resulted in my commitment to this church. Despite what it may sound like in the coming paragraphs, I had a pretty unremarkable childhood, and I wasn't abused or mistreated. I guess I just had a missing piece. I was a bookish, very, very obedient little girl. I was quiet, but I paid attention to things. I wasn't very old when I bumped up against the big rules and the big questions. It was when I was exposed for a time to a community church Sunday school, quite fundamentalist, where I learned about God. I wasn't sure that my parents knew about God, since they seldom went to church and never talked about him. But at the Sunday school, I learned that I was supposed to pray and read the Bible every day and tell other people that God wants them to do so too. This God watched over me every minute and expected me to be very good. I was only 8 or 9. We were supposed to memorize Bible verses in that Sunday school. There's one particular one that reached out and grabbed me. It's Matthew 5:48. Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. As far as I could tell at the time, that was the number one commandment, because if you're perfect, you don't have to worry about not killing and not stealing and all the other 10 commandments. Just be perfect. I remember thinking that it was possible to be perfect because we were taught that Jesus was perfect, but it was quite hard. I remember feeling that if I were perfect, then God would love me. I have never forgotten that verse, although, thankfully, its power over me lessened as I matured. But just imagine burdening a little child with that out-of-context bit of Bible. I have to say that thinking about that now makes me pretty angry. When my parents found out how seriously I was taking the stuff from the Sunday school, it was when I tearfully told my mother one day that I wished she was going to be able to come to heaven with me, because I'm sure she wouldn't. They never let me go back there. I got the message that it wasn't okay to talk about God or the Bible or the big rules, but I kept thinking about them anyway. I also wondered about the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. My parents knew about that one. It translated by me to be nice to people. Well, okay, if you're perfect, not too hard. But I remember noticing that although it seemed to be the rule for dealing with others on an individual basis, that is the people we knew, it certainly didn't work when it came to countries or groups. We were taught to fear people in other, especially communist countries, and collectively, we certainly were not nice to them. I knew about poverty on an international level. I knew about the Holocaust and about wars. I thought about that a lot too. I never talked about it with anybody. To me, the golden rule meant that if I were to be perfect, I would probably have to be a missionary in a foreign land, or at least a nun, and we weren't even Catholic. As a small child, I was scared a lot, and it was a secret. Fast forward to high school. I was still bookish, and I had lots of opinions, very conservative opinions, but I wasn't quiet. I questioned everything and everyone, especially the rebellious behavior of my peers, out loud. I probably broke every unwritten rule for how teenagers are supposed to behave, and I knew that it was impinging on my ability to have friends, but I felt I was being honest and mature, and no one else was. I was an excellent student, well-liked by my teachers, but I wasn't happy. I think I was still looking for ways to be perfect, although I wouldn't have said that. I went to the Congregationalist Church all through high school, looking again for answers in religion. It didn't provide me with any satisfaction. I didn't feel like I belonged there either. Humiliatingly, I can laugh now, in my senior year of high school, I was voted most argumentative girl by my classmates, and there's a photo of me in boxing gloves for all to see forever in that yearbook. I actually made a conscious decision in the summer between high school and college that I was not going to be that person anymore, that I would keep my questions and opinions to myself and not be so noticeably weird. I decided I wanted to belong more than I wanted to judge others or explore ethics or philosophy or religion. That was when I went into hiding. But fortunately, I met another weird person, my husband Burns, who was weird in a different way about this time, and I finally had someone to really talk to about big questions and big rules. With him, I also got a fresh start on the social scene, which is really great, since I was accepted by his friends just because I was with him. That doesn't mean that my questioning mind was satisfied. I still felt that I mostly had to hide around anyone except Burns. Until I became a UU, I don't think I ever stopped feeling like an outsider. Another fast forward to about 8 years into our marriage, when we moved with our two-year-old daughter from upstate New York to central Massachusetts, leaving all of our social connections behind. I guess I held on to the idea that there might be something for me at a church. I honestly don't remember the first time that we went to the Union Church of Northborough. But despite Bernie's reservations about it at first, we were both gathered into the life of that church so warmly. It's a wonderful memory. We became very active, and the rest is history. That was 30 years ago. I choose to be a UU because for the first time ever, I felt like I had a place where I belonged. In a UU church, I could grow and explore. I could be comfortable saying what I thought. I was accepted, even without being perfect. I started out in life an arch conservative, and I've been growing more liberal with every passing year, I'm very proud to say. I also found a source of religious education for my children, which would not be the confusing and negative experience that I had had. One of the most powerful moments I ever remember experiencing in a Union church was in the first year we were going to church in Massachusetts. In that church, child dedications are done on Christmas Eve, and we had asked that our daughter Carrie be dedicated. That's an emotional time of year for me anyway, and the deep wonder of having our first child was still fresh. At that service, I heard for the first time the quote from Sophia Lyon Foss, "Each night that a child is born is a holy night." For a moment, I actually couldn't breathe with the affirming truth of that sentence. To me, it meant that holiness isn't something outside of us that we endlessly need to grasp for, but that holiness is inside of us and our experiences. For me, it's an experience that I would actually describe as feeling like I was born again, as a UU. Well, now it's been 30 years, 23 of those years in this church. And I choose this church again and again, week after week, year after year. I choose to come, to participate, and to make this church a priority because although I have grown and changed, it still fulfills the personal needs that my first UU church met when I founded those 30 years ago. I feel a deep sense of gratitude for the ways that this church encourages me through the programs, through the sermons, the literature of Unitarian Universalism, and also the examples of other members living their searches for meaning. Over the years, the people that I have met here have become part of my first place, my family, as well as my third place, and I thank you all for that. I also choose this particular church because it's an institution that I respect. I believe that we do good in the world. I am so proud of the work this church does on social justice issues, the way we care for one another, the music we make together, the way that we try to live our values, by running the church here in Nashua and at the district and association level of this denomination. I'm especially proud of our outreach collections. This is our church, and it's the institution that we collectively choose it to be. So that is why I choose this church. Each of us has our story. That's a small story. And each of the stories is at a different length at this day, at this time. But they're all the reasons why we choose this church. I encourage you to think about your story from time to time and how it's developing. I want to change gears now and bring up the difficult topic of money, but we're mostly all grown-ups, so I think we can do it. Every year about this time, we hold a pledge drive. It isn't exaggerating to say that we collectively determine the financial future of our institution for the coming year during the pledge drive. The money we give to run this church is not a separate issue from the value that the church brings to our lives. Money is one of this institution's fuels. The pledge drive is for operating expenses, things like utilities, salaries for our minister and staff, building maintenance, and program expenses. We pledge, the executive board debates and agrees on the budget, which gets proposed at the annual meeting, and the members who attend the annual meeting approve or modify it. That's the process. This morning, I'm here as chair of this year's pledge drive to ask you to pledge as generously as you can so that this can be the church we choose it to be. But here we are in the 2009 pledge drive during what we are told could be the worst downturn in the economy since the 1930s. How do these two ideas come together? First of all, let's admit we all feel uneasy, at the very least. I know I do. We all know people who've been laid off, including some of us, and people in difficulty in other ways. Anyone with a retirement account is noticing. It's a time of uncertainty, and in one way or another, we are all affected. I think we can choose how we deal with this, though. There's no way that I can pep talk us out of the financial challenges we face this year in this church. The value of our endowment is down, with the depressed stock market, and therefore the amount of money we can prudently take from it to support our operating expenses is also down. To fund our budget even at last year's level, we will need to increase the total amount we raise in pledges. I'm standing up here to ask everyone you possibly can to increase your pledge. Please know I wouldn't do that if I'm not also increasing my pledge. If you've never pledged with us before, please consider it. Please join us. I feel cautiously optimistic that together we can get through this tough time and retain the vitality of our church. Just remember the matching gift campaign run by the Nashua Soup Kitchen and Shelter at the end of last year. With the matching gift, they raised over $1 million in a few weeks right here in Nashua. What an inspiration that was. I ask you to join me in refusing to give in to the fear of what may happen, but to pledge with faith and hope as your present circumstances allow. Know that your pledge can be adjusted if your situation changes. And I have a special word for those of us who may have lost a job or suffered some other reversal. Make whatever pledge you feel you can, or make no pledge at all, without apology. But please don't withdraw from the church. Stay with us and let this community of caring people care for you. Ultimately, the essence of this church is the people who make it up. Each of us is valuable, and we're all in this together.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Thank you. Well, again, really wonderful words. I don't have a whole lot to add to that as we get ready to close, other than to just reiterate very quickly some of what Ellen said about the importance of all of us pulling together right now. I mentioned earlier what you see around the room is really meant to symbolize the ways in which we are connected. Especially important to realize that right now, given, as we know, some of the uncertainties that some of us are dealing with. A couple things along this line. If financially speaking, you are in a reasonably secure place right now, then I do hope you will go the extra mile for us this year. And second, for all of us, again, echoing Ellen, let's pledge from our hopes rather than from our fears and anxieties, real as they may be. Your pledge is a good faith promise, so please treat it as such. If your circumstances in the months ahead make it difficult for you to fulfill it, we understand that. We'll deal with it if need be. Well, however long and fascinating my journey has been, I still retain an appreciation for where it all began, for some of the people I still regard as, rightly so, as fellow West Virginians. One such person is an African-American gentleman who was one of nine children, very hard scrabble family in the coal mining town called Slab Fork. Somewhere in his journey away from Slab Fork, Bill Withers discovered he had a gift for writing, composing, singing songs. One of them was Ain't No Sunshine. Another was Lean On Me. Withers was living in Los Angeles when he wrote Lean On Me, and he was thinking back, though, to how his family and how the people in that little West Virginia community, this is the story I got on it anyway, had to pull together during tough times, and that was when he wrote the song. It also speaks to one of the reasons that we're here. So we'll all have someone to lean on. So I think the choir is going to help us out with this. The words are in your order of service. We're going to sing that together, even as we ask you again to do all you can to support this wonderful community. We know at certain times in our lives we need someone to lean on, so let's